Grizzly One.
Their own organization called the Guardian Angels. You see them with red berets.
I admire Curtis Sliwa, and I think that he takes his life into his own hands doing what he does.
Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels founder and leader.
We've got Curtis Sliwa from WABC Radio.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New York.
The Drive at 5 with Curtis Sliwa. What happened today, why, and what's next? Live, local, on it, 77 WABC.
Minutes as once again yours truly Curtis Sliwa is taking you home on the drive home at five as we're high atop Madison Square Garden, the great facilities provided to us for this broadcast to all of you by NJDiet.com. And boy, this rhetorical battle continues. It started between the President of the United States and Congresswoman Frederica Wilson of Florida. In fact, this was the comments that the congresswoman made after the president had made a call to the widow of Sergeant Johnson, one of the four Marines who had been slain in Niger on special assignment to root out ISIS in that African country. Frederica claims that the call that the president made to the widow while on her way to the airport in Miami to retrieve her husband's body was actually heard by a number of people in the car.
He was almost like joking. He said, well, I guess you knew something to the fact that he knew what he was getting into when he signed up, but I guess it hurts anyway. You know, just matter-of-factly that this is what happens. Anyone who is signing up for military duty is signing up to die. And that's the way we interpreted it. And it was horrible. It was insensitive. It was absolutely crazy and unnecessary. I was livid.
And then the president had chastised her by saying, hey, you better beware because I've got proof that you're wrong. And the proof of that came about with the unexpected comments today by the White House Chief of Staff, General John F. Kelly.
I was stunned when I came to work yesterday morning and brokenhearted at what I saw a member of Congress doing. A member of Congress who listened in on a phone call from the President of the United States to a young wife and in his way tried to express that opinion that he's a brave man, a fallen hero. He knew what he was getting himself into because he enlisted. There's no reason to enlist. He enlisted.
And now the Chief of Staff defends the president.
He was doing exactly what he wanted to do when he was killed. He knew what he was getting into by joining that 1%. He knew what the possibilities were because we're at war. And when he died, in the four cases we're talking about, Niger, my son's case in Afghanistan, when he died, he was surrounded by the best men on this earth, his friends. That's what the president tried to say to four families the other day.
And then General Kelly talked about why he was stunned.
It stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation. Absolutely stuns me. And I thought at least that was sacred.
Now, on the line, we once again ask for Jeffrey Lord, the former CNN political commentator who used to get it on each and every night with Anderson Cooper until all of a sudden CNN said, no mas, no mas, we can't continue to have a super supporter of the president on board. So they came up with a fake, phony, fraudulent, fugazi reason to release him. But we always accept him here on the drive home at 5. Thanks for jumping on board again, Jeff.
Absolutely, Curtis. Good to talk to you all. This is kind of a sad topic.
Yeah, and what do you make of this back and forth? There is now politics injected when a president, whether this president or previous presidents, has the duty to inform a family of the loss of a loved one, either through phone call, letter, or by other means.
It just boggles my mind that politics would be introduced into this. I mean, let's remember this call came when this young widow was in a car, and for some reason the call was put on speakerphone. So instantly it was not a private phone call, and you had a member of Congress there who chooses to, who was not a Trump supporter, that's fine, but chooses to use the occasion of this to make a political game out of this, out of somebody's death. I mean, I just don't think it's funny, and I think that the absolute right person to discuss this was General Kelly, who is a Gold Star father himself, and has more than the capability to direct, I mean, he was sitting right there as the White House Chief of Staff when the call was made. He gave his advice as a general and a Gold Star father to the president on what to do, on how difficult these things would be. And he was the right person to come out and discuss this afternoon. And, you know, I have to say, this business of presidents calling and all this, Ronald Reagan called, I don't know if he called all 241, but he called a number of people when the Marine barracks in Lebanon were blown up by a terrorist in, I think it was in October of 1983. And he wrote about it later and said in his memoirs and said how difficult it was to do. It also, in his case, proved productive because the one father asked him, did my son, can you assure me my son did not die in vain or died for a good cause? And Reagan says he gulped and said yes. And he thought about that so much that he made sure that never again were American troops, with the single exception of Grenada, that he just wasn't sending troops willy-nilly into battle somewhere or putting them in harm's way in some fashion. So something good came out of it. But other presidents have done this. You can elect to make the call. As I understand it from General Kelly, President Obama did not call General Kelly.
Right, but
General Kelly's son was lost.
But you see,
I don't want to make politics out of that either. I mean,
I understand, Jeffrey. But actually, all of this was preceded by the president commenting on how he handles these matters compared to Barack Obama, Bush 43. Just listen to what he said the day before he made the calls to the Marine families who lost their loved ones in Niger.
I was told that he didn't often, and a lot of presidents don't. They write letters. I do. Excuse me, Peter. I do a combination of both. Sometimes it's a very difficult thing to do, but I do a combination of both. President Obama, I think, probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. All I can do is ask my generals. Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Now, wouldn't it have been better, Jeffrey, if he just left that whole subject matter alone?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, you get asked at these press conferences about this kind of thing. And I think he's just being very honest. He relayed what he was told by his generals. I mean, let's remember, this is not somebody, for that matter, like President Obama or President Clinton, who was in the military. So, you know, you want to turn to your generals for advice. And this was the advice that he got. And he was asked about it, and he related. I mean, I just think that fairly mundane, ordinary, average things that happen in government are being made into spectacular, terrible things when there's no reason for it other than sensationalism.
Well, in reference to how the president proceeds now, as you know, he got into that battle with the Khan family after Mr. Khan's presentation at the Democratic National Convention. They had lost their son also in Afghanistan. Wouldn't it be best if the president just, when it comes to the death of soldiers and what families think of him or don't think of him positively, that he just take the high road and not comment?
In the case of the Khan family, I mean, let's be candid here. I mean, yeah, are they a Gold Star family for which they should be, revered? Absolutely. But they were politicized by the Clinton campaign. The Clinton campaign put them out there to make a political attack on the president. I mean, they were used specifically, and used is the word, used specifically for that. So, of course, Trump and Trump campaign folks felt obliged, not shockingly, to respond to it. But just in general, I don't think these things should be politicized. And, you know, this was not a conversation that the president initiated in the sense, in a public sense. He was asked a question and he answered it. And then this congresswoman did quite readily seek out the cameras to make an issue out of this. And she's not a Trump supporter. I mean, she said all kinds of wild and wacky things about him in the past that she believes it's her right. She's a member of Congress. She's a right to say whatever she wants to say. But I think, you know, deliberately seeking to make this a political issue is a mistake.
Well, we'll see how this progresses today, Jeffrey Lord, after the comments of White House Chief of Staff Kelly, who gave the president tactical air support in terms of the style and method in which he made that call to the family of Sergeant Johnson, one of the four Marines who was slain in Niger.
Curtis Sliwa.
He's a man of the people.
Between the Scylla and Charybdis of commentary.
The Drive at 577 WABC.
It's been a month since Hurricane Maria flattened the island of Puerto Rico. 1 million people are still without running water, 3 million are without electricity. The governor of Puerto Rico traveled to the White House to sit with the president earlier today, seeking more relief funds for the island, which still, in many areas, has not seen any form of relief. And this is what the president had to say about that effort. And his own.
I think we've done a really great job, and we've had tremendous cooperation from the governor, and we are getting there, and people are really seeing the effort that's been put into Puerto Rico.
And then, remember how originally he said Katrina was far worse? Well, now he's flipped the script and says, no, Hurricane Maria did far more damage to Puerto Rico.
It was a 10. I'd say it was probably the most difficult. When you talk about relief, when you talk about search, when you talk about all of the different levels, and even when you talk about lives saved, you look at the number. I mean, this was, I think it was worse than Katrina.
Worse than Katrina. And the president gives himself a 10 in terms of the federal response. On the line, Arnaldo Salinas. We've had updates from him from the island of Puerto Rico as he has led Guardian Angels from the mainland as our senior director to help there. The Guardian Angels are already embedded as Puerto Ricans themselves. Thanks for joining us again on the Drive Home at 5, Arnaldo.
Thank you for having me, Curtis.
You heard the president give himself a 10, say he's done an outstanding job in getting relief to the desperate folks on the island of Puerto Rico. You've been there. What's your observation?
Well, I hope that 10 was out of a scale of 100, because it's definitely not out of a scale of 10. It's ludicrous. He's misinformed or he's delusional. Those are your only two options, or see all of the above. It's incredible that anyone would think that Puerto Rico is anywhere near its norm. Curtis, you know I've been there with the Guardian Angels, and it's a struggle day and night, contaminated water, no light, no school. Children just left there to their own devices. I mean, it couldn't be worse. Sooner or later, there's going to be a revolt on that island. And the little puppet that was sitting to his right, I mean, how can he say that he's the governor of Puerto Rico, yet he doesn't stand up to Trump? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Now, a lot of people listening to you, Arnaldo, would say, oh, Arnaldo, he's probably just a Trump hater. As I've told our audience before, you actually supported Donald Trump. You voted for him in the election, correct?
Yes, sir. Sadly, now that is correct. But when he's wrong, he's wrong. And he is dead wrong now.
All right. So now let's put aside what Trump thinks in terms of how good a job he's done in Puerto Rico. I see that you and the Guardian Angels have partnered up with the great salsa star Willie Colon and are conducting a benefit tomorrow night, Friday night, at the Church of St. Joseph. Is that in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn?
That is correct. The great salsa star and Puerto Rican legend, Willie Colon, has loaned himself out before this because he knows, and I have spoken to him. We've spoken about the children who need our help so that Puerto Rico will have a good future. And there are a lot of other people as well, Curtis, that have come to the forefront who have contacted me, owners of schools and shelters. They want to do more and more. And I've been able, thank God, to be the guardian angels to get kids from here connected with kids from there. And even though there is no internet, this is like the carrier pigeon days. I have to literally carry the donations and the goodwill wishes of kids here to kids there and vice versa. And not only do we have the mass tomorrow at St. Joseph's from 7 to 9, on the 16th of November, Willie Colon is giving a concert right at that church. And it's a concert slash telethon because this is something that needs to go on from now on. Willie Colon and I have already discussed going to Puerto Rico for the Three Kings Day in January and making this an effort that will last for years as a relief.
Well, Arnaldo Salinas, I want to thank you for the efforts you've done on behalf of the Guardian Angels in Puerto Rico. And if anybody can help, please make your way to the Church of St. Joseph. That's in Prospect Heights, Brooklyn, tomorrow night at 856 Pacific Street. The service starts at 6:30. It's a fundraiser for relief for the besieged island of Puerto Rico.
Curtis Sliwa.
The next mayor of the city of New York.
The Drive at 5.
Curtis Sliwa, legendary New Yorker.
77 WABC.
I know I smoked a lot of grass. Oh, Lord. I popped a lot of pills.
5:41 as we continue here in the Drive Home at 5. And President Donald Trump had queued him up. Congressman Tom Marino, Republican from Pennsylvania. He was to become the drug czar right here in the United States. And with that, the president was suggesting that he would declare a national emergency in that regard in the coming days with a national campaign to roll out. And all of that came to an end because apparently Congressman Tom Marino was more friendly to the pharmaceutical industry that was pumping out a lot of these pills than trying to cut back on them. On the line to discuss that is Dr. Jeff Reynolds, founder and CEO of Family and Children's Organization. Thanks for joining us again, Doc, here on the Drive Home at 5.
Always a pleasure, Curtis.
So explain to our many listeners this debacle of how a guy who was almost a day or two away from becoming our nation's drug czar had to scratch himself because of his relationship with the pharmaceutical industry, and how many others were implicated in this scenario that benefited those who were pushing pills as opposed to those trying to cut back on their distribution.
You know, the Washington Post and 60 Minutes did a joint investigation into all this, and it confirmed what we've already kind of felt out there, kind of in the trenches, that there's more to the story. And the allegation is that Representative Marino sponsored legislation that really hindered the DEA's ability to fight the opioid crisis and allowed distributors to just, in the words of the report, to pump millions of prescription painkillers into the population. It's not only him, but it's several other elected officials who all voted for this legislation. It went unanimously, so there's no good guys and no bad guys in all of this. They all approved it, and quite frankly, now we're left cleaning up the mess with overdoses that since President Trump took office now total more than 26,000 lives.
So let me get this straight, Doc. Marino was obviously pushing the legislation. Both houses, both the Senate and the House, unanimously passed it. Then President Barack Obama signed it. Was there anyone who was like watching the gate and reading the legislation and alerting the people who have hired them that there are problems here, you know, raising red flags? It seems like they all just folded like cheap cameras on this.
Yeah, it does. There wasn't a single member of the House or Senate that said this is a terrible idea. You know, quite frankly, all of them get contributions from the drug industry. And, you know, as some pointed out, the DEA and the Department of Justice could have at any point in time gone to the president and said, look, I think you're about to make a horrible mistake. Don't do this. Nobody did. And so it sailed through with nary a word. And like I said, now we're left to pick up the pieces. And, you know, we're doing the postmortem. And the postmortem is that, you know, there's more to the story. And the reality is the pharmaceutical industry has gotten away with what some would call literally murder.
So now the president, who has started and stopped, has not yet declared a national emergency in terms of the drug consumption in our country that has led to so many becoming ill and dying. And there's no national campaign to get rolled out yet. Why do you think he's delaying?
You know, I think it's disorganization. You know, the reality is that, you know, his commission on combating drug addiction and the opioid crisis said they were going to issue a report. The report didn't include a call for a state of emergency. Then they pulled it back and said, oh, we're going to do this. The president has been saying for weeks that he's going to issue a state of emergency. You know, look, we've got 150 some odd Americans dying every day. You know, that's basically the equal to enduring September 11th every 3 weeks. And so this president has, you know, thrown some positive statements out there, but we still don't have a state of emergency. Everybody agrees it's an emergency. Everybody talks about it as an epidemic and a crisis, yet we're failing to act. And quite frankly, some of that leadership needs to come from the president.
Well, you know, it's interesting because with former President Barack Obama campaigning for Murphy for governor to replace Chris Christie in New Jersey against Guadagno, the governor there is lame duck. It is already the middle of October. He's out by January. Would he be the perfect choice to become the Trump drug czar?
You know, I don't know. You know, at this point, I'm feeling like we just need someone that's going to take charge and begin to deal with this. You know, Trump during his campaign, along with the other candidates, said very, very compelling things about the crisis and made no bones about the fact that he saw it as a public health emergency and he was going to get on it. You know, the action isn't following. And, you know, beyond not declaring a state of emergency, the reality is that the president, the House, and the Senate are all looking at budgets that not only don't increase the budget substantially, but make cuts in some of the very departments that would be charged with leading this fight against opioids. And so, you know, for those of us that talk to patients and families every day, I feel like, you know, Rome is burning. People are dying. And meanwhile, we're not seeing the action we need to really put an end to it and save lives.
Do appreciate that, Dr. Jeff Reynolds, founder and CEO of Family and Children's Organization. But think of it. Now that Congressman Marino has been put on the shelf, the friend of the pharmaceutical industry that was pushing pills, not trying to restrict their distribution and use, does this open up a canal for Shamu El Jefe, Chris Christie, lame duck as he is in Trenton with nothing to do, as the focus is on the race of Murphy versus Guadagno to replace him? It's now the middle of October. There's only so many Dallas Cowboy games that he could be shuttled off to by Jerry Jones in his private chartered jet to cheer on the Dallas Cowboys, that outreditor that Chris Christie is. And I don't know about you, but I wake up early in the morning, real early, to go do a Good Day Early Call New York on Channel 5. So I get to see those Chris Christie anti-drug PSAs ad nauseum. Maybe the girl next to him who used to be the dope fiend, remember she used to be shooting up, selling her body in order to pay for the dope that she was ingesting. Maybe she'd be the better drug czar. Shamu El Jefe Chris Christie? God, makes me feel like I just soiled myself even to suggest that.
Curtis Lewa.
Really trying to help our cause.
The Drive at 5.
We're very honored to have him here today.
77 WABC.
Welcome back. Your dreams were
5:52 as we continue to take you home on the drive home at 5. Yours truly, Curtis Lewa. And whether you're returning to the borough of your birth, like Brooklyn, which birthed the schmuck, the putz, Chuck E. Cheese Schumer, the out the cock of Bernie Sanders, and yeah, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who certainly loves that port wine. Or it could be you're returning to the Bronx or Queens or Manhattan or Staten Island. The one fear sometimes people had is that a blue-haired matron might actually come hunting you down because you hadn't paid your fine for keeping your books out of the library for too long a period of time. But today, our intrepid news guy, Ken Duffy, came to the rescue to all of you who are deadbeats, slackers, and haven't paid up those fines.
Public libraries across the five boroughs are forgiving all late fees for kids ages 17 and under in a one-time amnesty event. Three of the largest library systems will forgive the fees and unblock library cards.
17 and under. So that doesn't mean me at 63. But I got to tell you how times have changed. Because so many out there listening, and it's not just inclusive to the five boroughs. This was true in New Jersey. This was true up in the Mid-Hudson Valley. This was true in Connecticut and Pennsylvania. You would go to your local neighborhood library, and it would be the blue-haired matron. Remember, baby boomers? And then all of a sudden, in order to get entree into what was the world of cyber information back then, totally different than what we're used to now with the click of a mouse. In fact, it was microfilm. Remember how if you could go into the back room, you could get access to all the old newspapers, and it was a black background with white print reversed the way it would be in the newspapers that you would purchase, and you could do your research and help in getting extra credit or getting your term papers graded up because now you had access to information that nobody else had. But in order to get entree to the world of microfilm, you had to make sure that all of the books that you had taken out of your local public library had been returned on time. And I got to tell you, we used to be in a panic. I would have books taken out and I would realize, oh my God, I got to get the books back before tomorrow, before daybreak, when the library opens up, because the blue-haired matron is going to come to my house. It's going to come to my house and it's going to have a order. And it's a no-knock warrant. They didn't have to knock on the door. The blue-haired matron would basically push the door open and say, I'm here to seize any books that are overdue here. And naturally, your parents were very cooperative. So you used to load up the books that had to be back before the start of the day, the business day. And I put it in my wire mesh basket on my Big Chief Schwinn bicycle and pedaled like Pee Wee Herman to the book depository on the side of the library. And you would open it up as if you were making a drop in a bank, you know, with a night depository drop. And you would put the books in there and hope beyond all hopes that that librarian in the morning would make sure that you got credit, that the books were returned on time. And then if you had the reputation as somebody who was a scofflaw, a deadbeat, somebody who hadn't returned library books, you were banned from the library in perpetuity. You couldn't walk in there. You couldn't read a magazine. You couldn't wait for your brother or sister. You couldn't sit with your grandmother or grandfather if they just wanted a cop a squat because they were walking through the neighborhood and the only place you could actually sit at times was the public library. You were persona non grata. You were a pariah. That blue-haired matron lived in the neighborhood. She knew who you were. She knew who your parents were. She would travel to your school as she did for me at PS 114 in Canarsie and Bildersee Junior High School. And she would knock on the door of the dean's office and would say, yeah, I want you to know, you got a scofflaw here. That's right, he's got two books out, Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. Guy's greedy. Why couldn't he have only taken one book out at a time? Can I hear that report again, how soft we've become in our society, how we have decided to fold like cheap cameras?
Public libraries across the five boroughs are forgiving all late fees for kids ages 17 and under in a one-time amnesty event. Three of the largest library systems will forgive the fees and unblock library cards.
You see what this means? Brian Mongalucci, our board operator, and you hipster invader, Justin Beloved from Alabama. If you give amnesty to scofflaws of library books, overdue library books, the next thing is amnesty for illegal aliens. That's right. And for those DACA kids, you see, one follows the other. I'm warning you.